This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 445 for December 14th of 2018, Buying Cars in the Age of Amazon. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, here we are back at it again, Autoline After Hours.
John, you know, 2 weeks ago we were in L.A.
Yeah.
And outside today here in Detroit, it feels like L.A.
It's kind of warm out there.
It is, absolutely.
Doesn't feel like Michigan in December.
Nope.
Hey, we got to let everybody know that Mike Whalen from Automotive News is back with us. Great to have you here,
always
as always.
Always a pleasure being on, guys.
Yeah. But our special guest for today is Ryan LaFontaine. He's the Chief Operating Officer of the LaFontaine Automotive Group, and great to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we should let the audience know, too, we're going to be talking all kinds of things on the retail end of the business. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about the latest news going on in the industry. If you want to get in on part of the discussion, we'd love to get some of your questions, too. So shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autoline.tv. And we'll take those phone calls, too. And that number is 620-288-6546. We can't guarantee that we're going to get to every single question, and if you keep them short and simple, we're more likely to get to them. But anyway, Ryan, tell us, give us a thumbnail sketch, LaFontaine Automotive Group.
Sure. So we've grown quite a bit. You know, it's been my, when I got out of college, we had just two stores, and now we have 20 dealerships.
20 dealerships?
Yeah.
Where?
All throughout the state of Michigan. So very grateful. We have about 1,300 employees, so we've grown. If you look at the last 5 years, we've added 10 stores, so a lot of rapid growth, but we do it because we've got great people, so very blessed.
And which brands do you sell?
So we have pretty much all the domestics. So if you look at, we have 5 Chrysler stores, we have multiple GM stores, multiple Ford stores, and then we have a lot of imports as well. We have Toyota, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Volkswagen, Subaru, Volvo. So we have a good mixture of all.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. We have diversity. It's good.
Cool.
So in addition to the growth, I mean, presumably there has been significant change in your business, the way you do business, and the way that consumers interact with you. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, by far. I was very fortunate. At a young age, my mom and dad both were active in the business, so I learned in our male and female tutelage. So a lot of the stuff that's going on today is kind of things my mom had us adapt a while ago, of really picking up and delivering to customers. We've done that for a lot of years. But really, everything's done online now. I mean, people obviously want, or at least are a lot more informed when they're coming, obviously, into our space. We have to be obviously prepared for that and react. They're not shopping as many dealers anymore. And then just what they're looking for. I mean, even looking at obviously cars and less cars and more sport utilities. So just the entire buying habit is different. And everyone wants us to respect their time because time, everyone's busy nowadays. So I really got to make sure we wow the customers and pick up and deliver and just take care of their needs.
What's the what's your focus these days? And what I'm getting at is everything I hear is the margins on selling new cars is like paper thin. Used cars, even better. F&I, better still. Sure. Back of the shop, best of all.
Of course.
Is that right? Is that how it's going?
The model hasn't changed. I mean, when I got out of college back in 99, I was told the exact same thing. Focus on fix-ups, focus on used cars, build the model there, and at that point, you can always sustain. Now, you fast forward, obviously, 18 years later, it's just now you have to. If you look at the model, margins, not just on new cars, margins on used cars have rapidly declined. Hmm. Obviously, it's more notable in new cars, for sure. Sure, and it's not just domestics, it's imports as well. So you have to be smarter. So, you know, as we've grown, you know, I try to sit here and take a look at what's coming in the future. So we've been preparing for this. So the last 2 years, pretty much 90% of our time has been spent on building up our service to what we want it to be, not just from a net profitability standard, but also on customer satisfaction. Same thing with body shops, same thing with parts. And then all the focus on finance and used cars. I'm very grateful to say we're actually having record highs in every single one of them. Service, we had a net swing of $2.5 million in 1 year. But it's buckling down and it's getting smarter. We can't outrun the interest rates and the hikes that have been going on. And an example in our group, we have $200 million of inventory. So every quarter point that goes up, our costs go through the roof. So not just are the margins obviously getting smaller, our costs going the wrong way. So we definitely have to buckle down and be smarter.
I'm interested. How do you feel about some of the factory programs kind of getting more involved in the dealership operations? We've seen it a lot on the domestic side, particularly mm-hmm. General Motors, sure. kind of bringing more data, more tools for dealers, but it's also kind of putting the factory's hand in the dealership business a bit more.
So it's always been a partnership. I mean, they've always been involved, and there's always been different objectives and programs. There's a lot more, and it's not just General Motors. All of them do it in regards to demands, in regards to what you might use or what's co-opable and what tools they want you to have for the customer experience, which is great to be uniform, but it also it's hard because it hurts our overall expenses keep on going up because we add all these tools. And there's so many great technologies out there. The problem is there's just too many of them. If you have too many, my managers aren't using them, so then they just become a dead expense. So we really got to hone in on that. And it gets tough because some of these objective programs on all of them, including some of the imports, they're becoming very, very unrealistic. And at that standpoint, a lot of the actual managers have to decide at the beginning of the month, am I even going to chase that number or not? And really, everyone should be focusing on selling as many cars as you can. And when they have to actually second guess that, saying, oh, I can't hit the number, so I'm going to cut back advertising, I'm going to cut back on what I'm doing, that's not a smart philosophy. So there's got to be a meeting of the minds because the way it's going on right now isn't necessarily jiving with and being conducive to really the customer.
You're talking about these stair-step incentives, yep. right? So that if you are incentivized to sell 100 cars and you hit that, boom, you get a bunch of money. And if you only sell 99, you're out of luck.
Did you want to buy a car because I hit 100 today? but it's right, and it's just a fact that the demand is getting higher and higher, and the objectives are getting higher and higher. And in certain cases, like our Highland store, we've been number one Buick dealership for probably six of the last 9 years. It's number three for Cadillac and number five for GMC in the entire world. So when you start doing those type of volumes, it's hard to one-up yourself the next year or sell more the next year. So at some point, you can't beat those records, right? They're all-time record highs. So as the market changes, we have to have the objectives change as well. So it's a combination of objective programs and then obviously tools that we're mandated to use and different technologies from reputation management to obviously CRMs to even sometimes what direct mailers we use. It does handcuff us.
Well, and you say mandated. Because all these programs are pretty much voluntary, they call them.
Sure.
But then you have to do them to get the incentives, or you have to do them to be a part of certain programs. So it's really interesting. I've learned a lot from Automotive News and the retail side of the business about the relationship between the dealer and the factory. And, I mean, some of the things that they particularly say are voluntary maybe aren't necessarily voluntary if you want to actually be successful.
Well, legally, I think they have to say voluntary.
Everything's voluntary. Right? You always have a choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that the design is bad. It's just it's hard to say one shop fits all. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of dealers, and some of them are very small dealers, some of them are huge dealers. So how can you say one program is going to fit every aspect? So in certain cases, they probably work great, and they actually probably enhance the tools that that particular might have been using, which is needed for the customer experience. But in other cases, when we obviously are ahead of the curve in regards to technology and have things like marketing teams or, you know, I have my own ad agency in-house that houses all of our internet and BDC, at that standpoint, we're sometimes handcuffed on other technologies. And that industry is changing so rapidly. I mean, you need to stay ahead of the curve on what's coming.
We've got a question here from Mark Kay. He says, if dealerships turn into park and maintenance lots for all these self-driving EVs that are coming, are you going to stay in business?
Sure. Great question. You know, we've researched a lot with subscription. We've researched a lot with autonomous. We've talked to a ton of people. And you still look at where the future is going. I mean, all the predictions are it's still going to be a smaller piece of the business than obviously people that obviously just want to own their own cars. So, and there's also a spot that where are they going to get service, right? And they also, franchise laws make sure they run them through a car dealership. So there's always going to be space, but the space is going going to change. I mean, the cheese is moving, and we have to adapt, but there is still relevancies for dealers, especially on the service side and obviously the delivery side, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, earlier this week, the Q4 Cox Automotive Dealer Sentiment Index came out.
Okay.
And it basically indicated that dealers are not optimistic, and I'm sort of, you know, all the economic news seems to be positive. Why would there be a negative feeling about going forward to the next quarter?
So it comes down to if you're not being smart and preparing for it, right? And if you look at the margins where they are with new cars, you can't survive. So if you're not flat out getting very good in finance, and if you're getting very strong in service parts and body shop, or looking for different profit centers to grow with, you can't sustain your business model. It's just impossible. So there used to be a day that the more cars you sold, you'd just be okay. So, all right, I'll sell more cars and we'll figure this out. It's just not that way. I mean, it's a very competitive landscape. Because of some of the objective programs, people are taking losses on cars. And at that standpoint, hoping they hit the objective monies. Well, when you don't, you know what happens. So it's hard model to manage, especially with we have 28 dealerships, obviously multiple brands, and everyone has their own recipe. So you have to figure out each brand's philosophy and how they obviously go about business and try to maximize it. But I can see why dealers are very frustrated, especially with the way expenses are going. Mm-hmm. It's just hard. All your expenses are going like this, and all your margins are going the opposite direction. And a lot of them just can't adapt. It's a lot of work. I'm in meetings all day, every day, and every topic is drastically different. I've been renegotiating contracts, like every contract in our entire company. It doesn't matter which department, to try to drive efficiencies to outrun the expense increases, because I'm not going to make it up on my margin. And I can't just always say, oh, I'm going to sell more cars. At some point, I mean, we're at an all-time record high, right, in the czar. So at some point, it's going to have to flatten out or maybe correct itself a little bit. I mean, no one's predicting that's going to completely drop off. But we're at all-time high. And if it's hard to make that profit today, then what's it going to be in the future? So that's where that's driven from.
I think that's kind of why you're seeing a lot of the dealer groups such as yours grow more, yeah. Because the one operation storefronts can't necessarily succeed how they used to. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a lot of mega dealers nationally and, I mean, even state by state, mm-hmm. kind of taking over a lot of the smaller dealerships that you've traditionally seen in some of the cities.
Very true. And it's a hard balance. You know, for us, we've gotten big, but it's very important to have that family feel and very much have its own identity. I mean, you have to be a fabric of the community. I mean, really, dealers get so involved in the grassroots marketing and really being involved in all the events and chambers and all those aspects. I mean, it's really part of the community. So it's important to keep that identity, but you do need the corporate disciplines to drive down the efficiencies, look for commonalities, maybe negotiate a different way because you have 20 different rooftops. Or example, like ourselves, our forecast for 2019 is to sell right around 30, it was just under 31,000 vehicles, new and used in the state of Michigan. So you can leverage that to try to get more efficiencies across the board on expenses. So
is 31 more or less than you sold this year?
So this year we'll see where we finally end up, but we'll be somewhere around 28,000 in the 28,000s, which will be an all-time record for our group. So we keep on growing. So we've been very blessed there. We got great people, but they have to. We literally switched our entire advertising strategy last year. You know, everyone talks about going digital, and obviously digital is a very broad scope term, right? But every facet of digital, and we've talked about it for year after year after year. Finally, last year, I switched, and we canceled all broadcasts, all TV, all radio, besides, I think, one radio station and a little bit of Comcast, and we went all digital.
And the results were?
We actually sold more cars. We actually were more efficient.
So you're never going back to broadcast.
So there's a balancing act. I'll probably be at around 75% digital and 25% broadcast.
You're saving money going digital?
You are. You are.
You're significant amounts of money?
And you can measure the results.
Yeah, very
good. So I can see it.
Right.
But there is something to say about brand recognition and being where the customers are. So keeping that awareness of the family deal for our sake. So I do want to make sure we're investing in that. But what I love is we change the culture. Is everyone just dependent on that natural traffic? They weren't as concerned at what their closing ratios were, or how many leads they had, or who's confirming those calls. By changing that switch last year, it forced that behavior, and it's really driven the disciplines we needed to succeed, you know, in this upcoming world and the way it's changed.
So you're mentioning digital. There are undoubtedly a number of younger people who say,
like myself,
who say, gee, I buy everything online. Why don't I buy a car from Amazon?
Sure.
So how are you going to deal with that reality going forward?
It's here. I mean, people want that. I mean, you know, nowadays, I mean, think about shopping for Christmas. I bet you all of us, majority of it was online. So people want that for it. Now, there is some laws that have to be overcome to allow that to happen for the full transaction. But there'll be a day that they have that loophole covered and the fraud protection in. I mean, there's a lot of facets to buying a car. So we've got to make sure the customer's identity and information is protected all the way through to be able to provide that service. But I guarantee it's not going to be an if, it's going to be a when. And it's going to be who can obviously provide that type of service and really while the customer's expectations. Customer demand, I mean, customers expect a lot. And we owe it to them, obviously, to live up those expectations. And we have to have people that are going to be able to be product knowledge experts because, I mean, these cars nowadays are computers. I mean, they're an extension of your iPhone or your Android. And everyone wants to be connected. And it's very technical. Delivering a car nowadays, I mean, used to take, oh, here's 15 minutes, here's your keys, let's go. It's a two-hour process at least. And usually people come back multiple times to try to understand the technology because you can't retain it all that day. It's amazing what these manufacturers have done with their brands, and you can say every one of them have increased their quality. It's not, you know, just imports. This, the domestics have raised their games substantially. It's awesome to see.
Gary,
Go ahead.
32, and I tried, and I was purchasing a car earlier this year, and I tried to do as much as possible online. Mm-hmm. And for a new vehicle, I got pretty far through online. And then had to go to the dealership to check it out, fill out the paperwork, and ended up taking still 2 to 3 hours. I then bought a used car, and I was about to go Carvana and just tried to do it completely online. And I found myself not being able to pull the trigger.
Why?
I had to see the vehicle. Because, I mean, as we've heard so many times over, a vehicle is the second largest purchase you'll ever have in your life. Not including a kid that you have to keep buying stuff for, but I couldn't pull the trigger without actually seeing the actual vehicle in person, and ended up going to a dealership and looking at it and buying it through a used car dealership rather than trying to pull the trigger online completely.
Yeah. That's very common because, I mean, it's true, and everyone takes care of their cars different. And every dealer or non-dealer or groups service their vehicles differently. So you have to see it. You got to look at the records. You got to understand what the car's been through, especially if it's depending on age. I mean, if it's a newer used car with low miles, maybe it not so much. But obviously, as there's more and more miles in use,
smelling it, seeing it, just making sure. I mean, it's not a lemon or
people
a dud.
Smoking at it. I mean, there's a lot of factors you have to look at. You can't do that online. So. You know, there's always going to be relevancy for dealers. Will there be as many dealers as there are today? I don't feel that this platform can sustain, but I think the strong dealers are willing to adapt and chase the cheese, because some just want to think the business hasn't changed. It's drastically changed. You know, when I got out of college, literally when I went to college in 95, we just started using internet. So I'm only 41, so I consider myself relatively young. If you think back in the last 20 years or so, how much has changed in our world? We'd be foolish not to think the next 20 years are not going to even be that much more drastic.
Yeah. Hey, we got a lot of questions coming in. You were talking about vehicles quality getting a lot better.
Yep.
Doug Hart says, are you going to be able to absorb your fixed rates with vehicles increasingly having high quality, low maintenance, extended change intervals, and more and more electrification, where you don't need tune-ups or anything like that?
Sure. So he's referring to whether we're going to have warranty work or not. Warranty work has been decreasing drastically every year for all the manufacturers. GM's warranty rate, amount of cars are coming for warranty recalls, or Ford or Chrysler. So we have not really been even focused on that. Of course, we take care of anything that comes up, but it's not our bread and butter. Where back in the day, it was probably 80 to 90% of our business. So it's traditional. It's maintenance. I mean, every vehicle needs maintenance, so it's maintenance. It's dealers getting smarter. I mean, our prices, a lot of people think their dealers' prices are going to be higher. You know, we price match pretty much everything across the board, so you can get your tires. You can get everything you used to go to all these different shops for. You can now, dealers are focused on making sure you know we can be a one-stop shop for you and retain that customer from new and used. But, yes, I mean, whether it's, there's going to be different certifications that our technicians need, even for the technology we have today. So as it goes more and more autonomous, past, but you'll see probably those technicians are going to be more like, you know, engineers that are working at the dealership, but there's still going to be space. Everyone's going to need to repair their cars, whether it be electrification, whether it be autonomous, whether it be whatever the next technology is and wave that comes, there's a relevancy for dealers to make sure we're servicing them and taking care of the customer's needs.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Brown says, Chevy dealers are upset the C8 Corvette will not be announced at the Detroit Auto Show in January. You sell Chevys. You one of those upset dealers?
So I'm obviously very passionate about the auto show. I was the chairman last year, so I was the youngest chairman in 111 years, so wow. I'm very proud of that. I firmly believe that anyone that's not launching them at the Detroit show is missing something. I mean, it's the largest for global press, so it's a hidden gem to get the extra exposure. So, yes, especially our own backyard, right, obviously with GM, Ford, Chrysler, which they're great partners. We need to make sure, obviously, that they focus on all their prime products being right here revealed. I think a lot of people think, oh, that should be a warm weather car, but you got to understand it's where the press are and where you can get the most eyeballs and exposure out there. And the show here in Detroit, I mean, it's a fabulous show.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan goes on to say that he bought an Alfa Romeo Stelvio Ti Sport in 15 minutes.
Sure.
He says, what's everybody taking 3 hours to buy a car for? We got to figure out how he learned, how he was able to do it in 15.
Sure. Internet, everything is done fast. I mean, responses now. It used to be you could respond in a couple hours. You got to be responding within 2 to 5 minutes with customers. So the demand is definitely there. We can do majority of the transaction, but because of state laws and different regulations, we still can't do the full transaction online. You have to come in the dealer. We are getting more prepared. Majority of our stores have customer appointment boards right when you walk in. You see your name. You're already greeted. You already know what's at. Everything's set up, ready to go with the car ready to go. So we've been investing in that type of customer experience because that's where it is. Everyone wants that quick Amazon, give it to me and show up in 20 minutes.
I plead guilty. Yeah,
we all do.
Let's see. Centurion 1973 says, please ask your guest why dealers are trying to block Tesla direct sales if they make so little on new car sales anyway.
Sure. So good question. But franchise laws are really in place to protect the consumers. Everyone thinks it's just to protect ourselves. So they put those things in place. And there's laws obviously in place abiding by to make sure everyone's on the same common grounds. So it's not that we're opposed to Tesla coming in. We love for Tesla coming in. It's just they have to go through the retail network.
Why? Why should they?
Because of the experience, the servicing center. If you look at that standpoint, you look at it making all the other dealers and all the other manufacturers have to do something like that. It's been there for a reason for the customer experience.
Last week we had Henry Payne here,
sure,
car critic from the Detroit News, who bought a Model 3 Tesla. He's willing to take it to Toledo to get it fixed.
Cleveland.
Yeah, until it breaks down on the side of the road, and he really needs help in that regard. So I understand people say that in theory, but obviously until it happens, you break down, and all of a sudden you need something reactive right away. So,
you know, there are, I think, 28 brands in the U.S. market. As of last month, Tesla outsold at least 18 of them, maybe 19.
Sure.
Aren't you worried about these guys? I mean, they are red hot.
I love competition. I absolutely thrive by competition. I think Tesla's a great competition. I think all brands are great. We have diversity. A lot of dealers don't have diversity. We have imports and domestics. And I think that them coming into the game is going to make all of the other manufacturers sharpen their skills on different technologies to be even better. But I think there's something even bigger coming from Tesla. Tesla just obviously gets talked about quite a bit. But looking at what these manufacturers, when I meet with all the CEOs behind the scenes of what they have coming, there's a lot of great products coming, a lot of great technology that obviously I think all the consumers are going to benefit from.
The problem is people aren't buying electric vehicles, they're buying Teslas. If you look at sales in the U.S., I mean, they're staggering for Tesla compared to all the other models when you add them up. It's really fascinating almost to see how this has kind of progressed.
Well, yeah, I agree, but let's think through. What made Hummer so great? I mean, it became popular. That wasn't sustainable, right? It was cool. Arnold Schwarzenegger was driving around once.
Don't you wish it was back right now? I think it would be so red hot.
So everything's cyclical. You got to understand, everything that's hot today isn't going to be hot tomorrow, and the good thing about diversity is balancing that. I particularly don't think the Tesla model is sustainable. I just don't think it is, but I think it's awesome what they're doing, and I think it's fast-forwarding everyone to focus on that technology more. So I applaud them in every way. I just think that obviously the retail network, the way it's set up today, is really set up to take care of the consumer's demand and make sure the experience, it's not just transactional. I mean, people don't want to just be a number. People want a relationship. They want to know when obviously their car breaks down or they have a problem or they need this. They want to know that they have someone there they can depend on. That's why people come back and buy from us for years and years and years. It's not just a car. It's a relationship. You trust. It's knowing that it's not just going to be when you buy the car. It's that entire life cycle and your kids and whatever they need. And dealers, there's a lot of great dealers out there, especially here in Michigan. I know most of them personally. I think a lot of dealers get bad raps. Honestly, majority of the ones I meet are great, great people. They're active in the community. They give back. That truly care. And you think about how many jobs are providing right here in our backyards. I mean, I employ 1,300 employees. Think about all the dealers in Michigan, how many people are employing that's sitting here helping out the economy and growing it. And some aren't in the best areas. And we sit here and get resilient. I'll never underestimate the power of an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur thinking the way they think. They'll be resilient. They'll kind of ride through anything. And I think Tesla's in that way.
Jeremy Jones writes in to say, thank Ryan. Go Northward U.
Yes. Yes, I'm a proud graduate. So, you know, I actually spoke at their auto show here just a little while back and I've gotten some awards from them. But we actually do an internship program with Northwood where we had 21 of their students here all summer long. And the year before, we had 20. So great organization that I'm very proud to obviously be part of.
They do a great auto show up there, the students they do. They put it on every year.
Ali, their chairman this year, was he shadowed me this summer. So we give every intern a mentor. So he was underneath myself, and he's just a great human being. He was a chairman last year of the auto show for them, and he did a great job. My niece, Savannah, is up there right now.
Brian, let me ask you. Once upon a time, I bought a Saturn.
Sure.
When Saturn still existed.
Yeah.
And there was a fixed price. Sure. I knew what everything costed. There was no dealing.
Sure.
Why is that not the norm?
Well, there was dealing. If you traded in a car, there was dealing. If there was financing back then, there was dealing. If there's product. So there's always dealing in a transaction. They just had one set price. Saturn, at one point, is a great example. They were Tesla back in the day. They were different. They were not the traditional approach, and that model wasn't sustainable. So I think there's great ideas that even came from that Saturn model back then, much like Tesla today, but doesn't mean that will be there forever. There is a lot of dealers that do one price. Yeah. I will tell you, tools like Viato and tools that we have, in many, many cases, it's not like before where you're negotiating thousands of dollars on a car. Our margins, a customer might be able to come in and negotiate maybe $100, $200, $300. It's so tight. I mean, we have to be competitive. It's automatically pricing our cars to market against all of our peers. So at that standpoint, we have to cut right to the chase. So we're almost in that model today. Obviously, in the state of Michigan, there's a lot of employee pricing. So in that case, it's a fixed price. But even in that landscape on new cars, consumers are well informed. So, again, it's not the days where we can sit here and try to have a huge margin and expect that we're going to keep that customer. Customers know. So we're almost at the model today without even just saying it.
So I mean, do you think it'll default to that? I mean, I think about, you know, you can go to Costco and they'll negotiate a price for you. You can go to AAA, they'll negotiate a price for you. And so it isn't, you know, the classic, you know, as you're saying, you go in and try to get a grand off or $2,000 off. And
so I think the day that we all start doing full transaction online, we'll have to be. Because at that standpoint, just like Amazon, you can't sit and have a fluctuation. You're going to have to actually know and have a defined price without no negotiation, no haggle. So even like things right now, we appraised your car without even seeing it, and we'll give you a price. Unless it comes in and has damage in this, that's what you get, and we'll give you a check. So we almost have it today, and I think as the technology keeps on going that way and customers' demand is more of that technology, we'll have to obviously adapt to more of that.
Is this a La Fontaine thing, or do you think this is an industry-wide thing?
So by far, it's not just a La Fontaine thing. I do think that we try to stay ahead of the curve as much as possible. I have a full team. You know, like I said, I brought in an ad agency that we created and made a difference, so they're involved with my business. I love ad agencies, but they don't know what this particular store. Maybe my Ford store in Birch Run might be having different things that they had to work on than maybe my Highland store, which is the Buick GMC Cadillac store, or different than Dearborn. So by having your own team that's focused on digital, where the world's going in digital, folks on internet, folks on leads, folks on the entire footprint, including broadcast TV as well. We're just being smarter and focusing on what the customer means. But there's a lot of great dealers out there that this is the conversation I'm having with them all day. So by all means, it's happening at majority of the stores. Do I think that there's some dealers that are still stuck in their ways and they aren't going to change? Sure. But that's human nature. But most are adapting.
White shoes, white belt.
Yeah, it's still there.
There's still a few. We're going to have to wrap this segment up, but one quick question. What do you think about subscription services?
Sure.
You know, Volvo's really pushing it, for example. So. And does that get you to the just the stated price and not negotiate?
Sure. So I like subscription. We have a Volvo store as well. So we've obviously watched that model there. We've obviously watched it with Book Cadillac. We've actually talked to Mobility, and we've talked to all of them. Chance and myself saw it many, many times. I think it's a great program, and it's kind of like leasing was back in the 80s. It was another financing source for customers. This will be another option. So much like leasing is an option, and purchasing is an option, this will be another option, and it's going to appeal to some people. It's not going to appeal to everyone. And there's going to be certain people that love the convenience of it. But you're also seeing a different space than just what they advertise, that it's a person that wants to, they need a car during the week, but they need that Yukon XL for the weekend to go up north. They want the sports car. That's not even the full model. It's also the people that are coming in state that maybe are just doing a job share here for 6 months and they need a vehicle to drive. There's a lot of applications where subscriptions make sense. And I think it's going to evolve. In our particular state where leasing is so heavy and you can get such an inexpensive lease, it's hard to make that business model make sense. If we were outside of Michigan, I'd probably be doing it right now. We most likely are going to still do it, even in the state as it evolves. But I've been watching all the other states and all the other dealers that have been doing it to see where the shortcomings are, because it's a fine balancing act with depreciation on the vehicle and obviously what to charge and what a consumer will pay. And sometimes that math doesn't equal what the car is going to depreciate. So we're watching it, but it's great. It's awesome to have for the guys. It's an option. People that do the Volvos, they love it. They absolutely love it. But that's more like almost like a one-year lease. You know, it's a subscription, but it's not where you're switching in and out all the time. It's almost just a shorter-term use of the vehicle.
Yeah. Real good. With that, we're going to have to wrap it up. But thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Interesting discussion. Yeah,
I appreciate it. Thank you guys for the time.
Yeah, no, great to hear that you guys are growing, too. Yeah, that's awesome.
It's fun. You know, we've grown rapidly, and it's great to have my parents still active and my sister, obviously, my right arm of the business. So we have a lot of fun. It's a family deal after all, right?
That's right. There you go. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone, and we're going to be back talking more about cars and the car industry. Okay, we're back talking all things automotive. And, of course, this is the part of the show where Dr. Data throws a number our way.
Okay, so this relates to part of the discussion that we just had with Ryan. And so I'm going to, in these numbers are from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So this is about employment. So in 2016, in the United States, there were 749,900 of these people. In 2017, their median pay, we were talking about medians and average last week. This is the median pay.
Yeah.
Was $39,550 in 2017. Okay, so now we're talking about 750,000 people, roughly, making roughly $40,000. And in 2026, the Bureau of Labor Statistics anticipates that there'll be closer to 800,000 of these people.
So my guess, when you throw that number out, would be people who work in the automotive industry, all aspects, car companies, supplier companies, car dealerships, you name it.
That was my initial thought on that, but I'm almost thinking 2016, I was thinking Uber or Lyft drivers or something around that nature, but that's way too high of a number, I think, for that amount of people back then. As usual, you sell me on these.
You're both wrong. Automotive technicians and repair people.
Wow, that many.
That many. And they're saying the outlook is good. Now the reason that this struck me was I came upon a piece on a website, Clean Technica, which basically said that recently published studies from the UK's Institute of the Motor Industry, so this is in the United Kingdom, reveal that as many as 97% of active auto mechanics aren't qualified to work on electric cars. And of the 3% who are qualified, the vast majority of them are employed at manufacturer dealerships, presenting prospective EV buyers with very limited service options.
Yeah. Well, I can believe that, you know, that most techs would not know about batteries or electric motors per se. But that's the only thing they would not know about. Anything else on the car, they'd be able to work on.
Right. So I mean, it gets back to this thing that, I mean, as you know, we're going forward and you know, as Ryan alluded to, that, I mean, there's going to be, you know, an increased number of electric vehicles. And how do you get them fixed?
It'll be a trickle-down effect, though, because, I mean, once you actually have the supply to fix, then people who are certified in that dealership will then go to another outside place for possibly more money or start their own business. So, I mean, it's the kind of chicken and the egg thing. You can't really have one without the other at this point, I think.
Well, you know, think about it, too. Electric cars don't need tune-ups, no oil changes, no filter changes, nothing like that. So there's going to be less maintenance with them. Because of regenerative braking, the brake pads don't wear out as quickly. Typically what does wear out more quickly because of the torque that you get are the tires. So the tire companies love the fact that EVs are coming, although they're also very careful. And I know, you know, Bridgestone's one of our sponsors here. They would not bid on Tesla's business because Tesla's, especially the P100Ds with ludicrous mode, they were getting 10,000 miles out of these tires. And I know that Bridgestone bid on Chevy's Bolt EV once GM agreed to an algorithm change that would not get as much tire rub under acceleration. I don't know what they did, but that's when Bridgestone said, yeah, now we can meet all your warranty needs, GM, and stepped up to it. So, but anyway, long story short is, I think there'll be plenty of work for techs to do at repair shops and the like. It's just not going to be on engine, piston engines and, and doing tune-ups.
It still will be, especially in 2026, I think you said. I mean, the amount of vehicles on the road today and how, well, we were talking about the quality and how much they're lasting and how longer they're lasting. I mean, we're not going to switch to an all-EV future overnight. And I think a lot of people read the headlines, read this, and think that autonomous all electric vehicles, everyone's going to have them in their driveway in 10 years. It's not even going to be close.
Well, as they reported on AutoLine Daily today, the sales of EVs were up 176% in November. So,
but to Mike's point, it was all Tesla.
Yeah.
And if you take Tesla out of it, EV sales were down 58%. And that comes back to your point, Mike, that people aren't buying electric cars. They're buying Teslas.
Yes, and I mean, it's just watching them evolve over the years and from the Model S, and I love driving the Model S, and I've been in the Model 3, and Henry Payne and I talk quite frequently, and I've followed him on getting his Model 3. But their brand, the reputation they have, and the persona that they've given is what people are buying. It's almost like the only thing in the auto industry that could come close to it is Jeep. If you throw a Jeep nameplate on something, it's going to sell. It doesn't really matter what it is.
Spoken by the man who used to cover FCA.
Yes.
So you have a pretty deep knowledge of that whole thing. Which you know, this, I hadn't thought about this, but so as you're the former FCA guy, and what do you think of Mike Manley running the company now? Since you have some insight to that that most of us don't.
I miss talking to Mike. I used to be able to talk with him probably once a quarter, and he was always a great guy to speak
He'll
with.
He'll tell you anything.
Depending on if he wanted to.
When I say anything, what I mean is so many other execs, you know, oh, I don't know if I can tell you that. Mike would just tell you.
Well, that's the FCA kind of mantra from Marchionne. They empowered their executives to speak their mind and to do what they would like. And that either was very good for them if they were successful or very bad if they weren't or if they disagreed with Sergio or kind of crossed the line. And Mike Manley, I mean, is a prodigy of Sergio. And it was great just being able to talk with him. And like you said, actually get answers and get news. A lot of times you'd go back from an interview with him and you'd throw a dart at the board to figure out what you're going to lead with, kind of how Marchionne was. But yeah, Manley, I think he was a workaholic just like Marchionne. But as we've seen, he's kind of delegated a lot of the responsibilities that Marchionne had with the multiple hats to some of his top lieutenants, even brought up outside people, which Marchionne never did. So I think he took a lot of the learnings from Marchionne and transformed them or evolved them a bit to kind of lead the company how he wants to and not go insane.
Don't you think that FCA is an extraordinarily well-run company right now?
That's a double-edged sword there. I mean, their Jeep and Ram business is doing amazing. They were ahead of the curve with canceling the cars. However, if you look to their future tech, where we think a lot of the industry is going, they aren't there. And Marchionne's confessions of a capital junkie, of consolidation and wanting to combine with GM, combined with pretty much anyone who would want to dance with them, is coming to fruition. We've kind of been seeing it slowly with people partnering up or acquiring other companies. But I don't think FCA is positioned as well, particularly GM, on the side of future product and where they need to be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, future tech.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that sort of brings up another topic, which I hadn't thought about, but I know you're covering it very closely, the Renault-Nissan situation with Mr. Ghosn. And, you know, reading reports on that there was an issue of, like, whether the two would actually fully combine, go beyond this partnership that they have. And then this other idea that now that they may split apart. Where do you think this is going?
Well, my guess is the French government really wants to keep Nissan. And it's got all the clout on its side. I still believe that's one reason why Carlos is in jail right now, is they were looking for any excuse to try to get more leverage. Nissan's looking for more leverage in the partnership, and Carlos made it easy for them. You know, he didn't report $40 or $80 million in income, whatever the number turns out to be. But, I think even if they stay together, if it's a flawed marriage like it is right now, flawed marriages don't last. Even if Renault doesn't want to let Nissan go, the whole thing could collapse.
It's something out of a movie. I mean, if you read some of the reports coming out of Europe and Japan, I mean, it is a play-by-play, and it's almost a soap drama on someone saying one thing the next day, then contradicting it the other. And it's almost like a spy thriller that people are trying to collude to take him down. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I think once we hear the full story, once Ghosn actually comes out of jail, and I'm assuming this is probably going to end up in the courts at some time, it's going to be really interesting to see what actually comes out as fact and what comes out as fiction.
But do you think Renault and Nissan will stay together, or do you think that Nissan will just be Nissan and maybe Mitsubishi because they're two Japanese companies and Renault will be Renault?
I'm with John on this one. A flawed marriage is eventually going to likely fail. And I think without Ghosn, kind of who many thought was the glue holding all that together, him and Marchionne were these two figures of the auto industry that we don't see very often anymore. And I think especially with him Ghosn, presumably, I don't think it's going to last. No.
So then it brings up the question, I mean, as you said, that Sergio had looked desperately to try to find someone with which he could combine FCA because he thought that scale would be beneficial. What happens to Renault and Nissan if they become independent companies?
Well, somebody just wrote an interesting article. I wish I could remember where I read it, that shows that most collaborations in the automotive industry have been total fiascos.
That disband, yeah.
They just don't work.
Yeah.
You look at Ford and all the brands it had. You look at GM and all the brands it had. You look at Renault, Nissan. You look at a number of the others. It's hard to find collaboration between car companies that work.
Look at just some of the projects they've done. I mean, GM and Ford on the transmissions for high speed. Ford kind of ended up not doing the 9-speed. They dropped down to the 8, I believe, instead of doing the 9 that GM kind of developed. Ford did the 10. And we've seen it with Dan Akerson before when they were trying to partner with PSA Group. That kind of fell apart. And it's just very difficult when you have two contrasting companies, and not to mention cultures, trying to work together. And that's why we kind of held Ghosn as well as Marchionne in this high esteem, because they were melding these companies compared to something like Daimler Chrysler, which ultimately just unraveled and failed.
But, I mean, isn't the common wisdom that there are too many car companies and that needs to be consolidation in the industry?
Right.
Okay, and if that's the case, If Renault, Nissan, Mitsubishi Alliance fragments, yeah. then in effect, this is adding to the number.
Yeah. Well, that almost doesn't matter. Look at all the Chinese car companies. And now look at all these EV startups. So, I mean, I remember this goes back decades ago when hardcore, really good experts were predicting there would only be five car companies in the entire world by the year 2000. And now, and this was a prediction made around 1980. And now we've got way more car companies than there were in the year 2000. So I don't see it coming to any end anytime soon. I believe it will happen. But, you know, now we've got these mobility companies getting in there, too. So
okay. So to be fair, are name brand companies going to merge or go away within the next 5 years?
5 years is a pretty short-term outlook, I think. I'd say maybe a few, but I think 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, we're going to see a lot more consolidation. And because you have to have the funding to support all this new technology, and like we were just talking, making a vehicle and selling it doesn't make you that much money anymore like how it used to, especially when you have these escalating costs and when you have the automakers trying to go and become mobility companies, buying scooter companies, which I don't understand whatsoever. But
buying them or the scooters?
I'm fine with the scooters, okay. But I don't understand the automakers trying to get in the game. I understand the first and last mile thing. But I think the ride hailing and the ride sharing are where they're going to kind of see more growth than the little scooter e-bike companies, I mean.
Hey, we can talk more about that. We've got a number of phone calls and other questions from the audience. I know, Gary, you've got more topics, but we're going to take a quick break right now. Give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back talking all things automotive. I had mentioned there's a couple of phone calls. Carmen, why don't we bring the first one of those calls in?
Great show, guys. Jonathan out in Old Lapan, New Jersey. I got a question. Are car manufacturers moving to their car reveals to hotels outside of the Cobo Center and other shows throughout the year? Are they having the events at the hotels so they can control the press for a longer period of time and give them all the information about their models? Could that be where new cars are going to be released now, as opposed to at the car show where they run like a half an hour press release, press conference? Could the press conferences. Could the press conference for new vehicles be at hotels? I think the Europeans are doing that. And I think maybe some of the American car manufacturers may be doing that, hopefully in January at Detroit. Anyways, great show. A lot of fun. Have a good one.
Thanks, Jonathan. You guys want to take a stab at that?
Answer is yes.
Yes, I mean, and it's been occurring for a while.
Yeah.
A lot of automakers have been moving away from auto shows. We're just seeing it kind of escalate a lot more as they try to pick and choose how they're going to spend their funding. And as you were kind of saying on the phone, captive audience. And a captive audience where you control the messaging much more than having someone run from press conference to press conference every single 20 minutes, and you can have them and kind of take them through every step of the new vehicle that you just spent millions, sometimes billions of dollars kind of developing.
Well, and just so Jonathan and the other viewers and listeners understand. So, for example, last year, the Silverado,
that Saturday night.
That Chevrolet did it Saturday night at a venue which was...
You're talking for the Detroit show,
yeah,
which officially started Monday.
Right.
Chevy did an offsite on Saturday.
On Saturday, and they had media there. They had Silverado owners there. Yep. They had, and it was... They rented basically...
It was a big bag.
It was large.
Like a warehouse space that
and
they basically...
It was probably cheaper than doing a 25-minute press conference inside the auto show.
Exactly. And auto shows, when it comes down to it, they're about the public. That is the main draw for auto shows, is for the public. And these vehicles are then just displayed there. The press conferences and the unveilings are great for the media and everything, but the public doesn't see those necessarily anyway unless they're seeing live stream or anything like that.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, the auto show is still important for the public, but it's becoming less important for the media because the automakers are deciding to not necessarily unveil vehicles there.
Okay, but to be fair to the auto shows, it seems to me that the only way that these off-site events work is if there is a critical mass of journalists that happen to be in town for that, right?
For the auto show.
So they go there for the auto show,
yeah,
and instead of... So they happen to be, in some hotel downtown, and they're already staying there. And then they get an invitation to say, oh, Sunday night we're having and this is what Mercedes would always do. They'd always have an event at the Book Cadillac Hotel, right? And they would say, okay, come to the Book Cadillac Hotel on Sunday night, and we're going to show you a car we're not even going to reveal at the Detroit show, and we'll feed you dinner. and so everyone would go to that. But if the journalists weren't in town...
Right.
It wouldn't work.
And this pisses off the auto show people at every auto show. They do not like these off-site events for the very reason that you cite.
However, if you look at General Motors particularly, they unveiled the Chevy Blazer at a private event off-site. They've been doing this for a lot of years that aren't necessarily connected to the auto shows. It's just them trying to get more bang for their buck, and they're not going to let the auto shows depict or kind of like demand where they are going to unveil a vehicle anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Whip Good just wrote in to say, we need more fashion tie-ins at auto shows, like AMC did with Pierre Cardin Interiors and Javelins, and Oleg Cassini AMC Matador with copper and bronze trim. I like his idea a lot. I think you could do a lot making auto shows more than just cars. I think bringing in fashion is actually a pretty interesting idea.
This is pretty much my standard outfit,
averse. Didn't Cadillac try to do that when it moved to New York?
Did they?
Yeah, I think that that was part
of
it. I know that Mercedes has been a sponsor of Fashion Week in New York. So, I mean, there's a tie-in between the two. But again, I mean, it's, auto shows are, we're going to see what Detroit is going to be in 2020 when it sort of blows up, I think, the nature of what we expect an auto show to be and do something completely different.
Well, and they're trying to tie it into the Grand Prix, which is going on, and make it more of an event, a holistic event, not just cars. So, I mean, they're kind of moving to that venue, but I'm not sure how necessarily it's going to pan out exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one does.
Gary, what else do you have on your list of topics there?
Well, I thought it was interesting that we were talking about electrification. Daimler buying $23 billion worth of batteries between now and 2030. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, just a tiny bit.
So is this indicate that these guys are basically all in?
Well, I think what it indicates, if they're buying that, look, everybody's afraid of not being able to get enough lithium, yeah, being able to get enough cobalt, et cetera.
Huge issue.
And so does this mean that Mercedes has locked in contracts for the next dozen years? If so, that could be a real competitive advantage.
But having all of those batteries does it little good unless it is able to sell the products that are,
and we've seen automakers do this generally on materials.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically, Ford lost $1 billion hedging its buy for platinum for catalytic converters, and then it turned out that through design advances, we didn't need as much platinum, and for whatever other reason, the price of platinum crashed,
mm-hmm,
and it cost the head of purchasing his job because he had spent $1 billion trying to protect the pricing of this material.
Well, and you mentioned Ford. I mean, Ford kind of did try to do the same thing with the aluminum truck, and we saw reports of GM and FCA trying to buy more aluminum and have it kind of in the back and have it in storage so that they could use that on the future vehicles. And that didn't necessarily play out as a lot of people thought. But, I mean, with the lithium and the cobalt, it's kind of a new territory for a lot of this because of where the cobalt's coming from, and it's amazing.
I.e. a war zone in Africa.
Yeah, and it's amazing actually how popular cobalt articles are for news outlets because engineers and the companies want to read about them and find out what's going on. But you also have some people such as Fisker looking at solid state and other technologies, fuel cell, which kind of on the same coin but a little bit different and a little bit different of a chemistry to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So according to Daimler, engineers are working on a battery that is 90% nickel, 5% cobalt, and 5% manganese, versus the one that'll be in the EQ that'll be coming out next year is 60% nickel, 20% manganese, and 20% cobalt. So basically going from 20% cobalt to 5% in.
Well, that's what they're
researching. Changing the chemistry.
I believe all this stuff. There's more smoke and mirror with EV batteries than any other part of the business right now. Mm-hmm. I'll believe solid state. I'll believe low contents of cobalt. Yeah. When they have.
Exactly.
Because right now, I don't believe any of that.
All right. So speaking of right now, this week you drove the new Ranger.
I did. The new Ford Ranger.
And they have some remarkable numbers in terms of MPGs.
They've got some pretty decent fuel economy numbers. I want to say for the base truck, it's what, 22 miles per gallon combined, 26 highway?
So the 21 city, 26 highway, 23 combined.
Oh, 23 combined. Okay. Yeah,
which is basically best in the segment. So how'd you like the truck?
I liked it a lot. And, you know, when they first showed it to us very early this year, January this year, I thought, geez, that's exactly like the one they've been selling in the rest of the world.
Actually, they showed it to us in December, and it was before the auto show.
Oh, okay.
An off-site.
I believe that was actually a Euro spec model that they brought over.
Oh, okay.
So,
but in any case, the new one looks exactly like it. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why did you guys do that? In fact, we did a piece in Autoline Daily about this. They had to change everything on the truck. I mean everything. The powertrain's different. The drivetrain's different. The interior's different. Even all the sheet metal. You know, they had to duplicate the tooling, so they massaged that to get better panel gaps. And I said, if you had to duplicate all the tooling, why didn't you just go with a new design? It wouldn't have cost you anything. And they said, we wanted to keep all the hard points exactly the same because that made the engineering of the North American version so much easier.
Yeah.
And this one I do believe a lot, they could take lessons learned from plants elsewhere in the world and apply them to the Michigan truck plant where the U.S. Ranger is going to get built. So, but I thought at first the styling looked a little stodgy, but I got to tell you, as we were driving around and I'm seeing them coming and going and uphill and downhill and all, the styling's really grown on me. It's a good-looking truck. And we're not supposed to talk about driving impressions, but I think one thing I can get away with is saying, when you get in a Chevy Colorado, it feels like a big truck. It doesn't feel like it's all that much smaller than a Silverado. When you get in the Ranger, it drives smaller. It does not drive like a big F-150. And I think that's going to appeal to a lot of people who want a very capable truck but want to be able to park it in their driveway or, excuse me, in their garage. And I know my wife has complained on the big trucks that I bring home to test drive. She don't want to get in on them. They're just too big, bulky, and cumbersome. I think even she would like something like a Ranger.
Okay, but it's dimensionally similar to the Colorado.
Yes.
Okay, but it just
drives different.
Yeah. Well, look, if you get in a Ford Expedition, it feels like a big, giant vehicle. If you get
it
in...
It is a big, giant vehicle.
It is. But if you get in a Suburban or a Tahoe, they drive much smaller than the Ford does, even though dimensionally they're not that far apart. They feel a lot smaller. The Ranger feels a lot smaller than an F-150.
I have not driven the Ranger. However, I think the Ranger name is going to sell people on that vehicle. But I think that midsize truck segment is going to have too many competitors coming into it again, and we're going to see a very cyclical nature for that segment, and it's going to peak with the Gladiator coming in and the Ranger coming back and GM redesigning or refreshing the Canyon in Colorado. Toyota, I think, has the most to lose out of all this because their truck, it's not my favorite in the midsize segment.
I believe there's an all-new Tacoma coming next year.
And I think we're going to hit that peak next year or two, and then we're just going to see it slowly trickle, because when the industry starts to stall, I think we're going to get to see more overlap of that full-size truck market and the midsize, how we did 90s, 2000s.
I tend to agree with you on this. I do think it's possible the midsize will start to cannibalize the full-size.
And that's why Ford didn't want to do the Ranger in the first place.
Exactly right. In fact, Wright Knight 170 calls in to say they should have called the Ranger the F-100, which I kind of agree with him with. But to your point, Mike, there's, what, an owner base of like 6 million Ranger owners or previous owners out there, so Ford can tap into them.
This is a really different Ranger, though. I mean, it is from a lot of those people who had that vehicle prior to them discontinuing it. And I think it's going to be a little bit of a shock how different the vehicle is. I'm not sure about the driving, but it's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out in the midsize truck segment.
So meaning they're going to remember, or they're going to have had or still have a smaller vehicle that is called a Ranger. Now they're going to go to their Ford dealership and they're going to see this thing that maybe it drives small, but it still is a sizable vehicle. I mean, it's not small. I mean, just the same way that the Colorado and Canyon are.
I mean, a lot of new car buyers, new vehicles on the road are 11, 12 years old now, who are coming back into the market. Think about the cars 11, 12 years ago. I mean, technology has just grown so much that a lot of people are going to the dealership and realizing, what? This is everything in the car? I'm not sure I want this. A lot of the truck buyers particularly want a basic pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find.
We're talking about Ford. I'm told from the control room we got a phone call about Ford. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. You know, now with Ford expanding their use of aluminum in their vehicles, which we all know is military spec, and then their slogan change, I feel that they're losing possible switchers, as they may feel that the vehicles are no longer built Ford tough. I'd like everybody's opinion on what this possibly could do to Ford. Great show as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the question there, Dale. Yeah, what do you guys think? You know, they've been advertising their trucks built Ford tough. Now they're advertising built Ford proud.
All right, so if we look at it, the quote-unquote all aluminum using military-grade aluminum.
I've heard of that
before. F-150 came out. It was a model year 2015. So there really hasn't been a reduction in sales of F-150s. I mean, it seems like
they almost hit a record this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's like month after month it keeps growing. So I don't think they have anything to worry about.
No, I don't either.
I don't think
And my guess is, you know, they've only been using the built Ford tough, where they drop the big logo on concrete and break it in their TV ads, to going to built Ford proud, and now use that tagline on more than just the trucks.
Yeah.
Use it across the line.
Scooters, bikes.
That's right, Gary. That's good. Okay, you got any one more thing? Because we got to wrap it up.
All right, so 3 or 4 months ago, we had Simon Sproul from Aston Martin on the show. Mm-hmm. And so Aston Martin is building this vehicle, the Valkyrie, which will be a limited production thing. And so it's a 6.5-liter V12 engine that weighs just 206 kilograms.
Which is pretty light.
Which is exceedingly light. And it's going to put out 1,000 horsepower. Is this crazy or is this genius?
Well,
I know you would like to drive a 1,000 horsepower car.
I think by law, everybody should. But look, for Aston Martin, you know, they've done this IPO. Their stock's gone nowhere. They're all about halo cars. I believe what I'm reading into everything that you're talking about here is they want the most uber halo car of all time, at least from Aston Martin. And, you know, get some more buzz going about the brand, and maybe that'll rub off on the stock price.
I mean, different market, but Dodge Hellcat, Dodge Demon. I mean, those are some old vehicles we've talked about, I think, previously. Throw in a 707-horsepower engine. People started noticing it a bit more. So even if Aston Martin's is grabbing some headlines with this and getting some buzz, it's more than they've been getting. I mean, truly.
Okay, so my question is we'll take it in a slightly different direction. And this is how you know we're coming to the end. So Pininfarina is going to come out with a car called the Batista, which will be 1,900 horsepower, but it'll be an electric vehicle. So here's the question. I mean, does horsepower still sell?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, when you're – and I don't know what Aston's going to charge for their car, but it's got to be $1 million, $2 million. $3 million? Okay, $3 million. They put some profit margin into that one. But, when you spend $3 million and people go, what are you, stupid? You know, what are you, I don't know, you're rich, but are you – You go, yeah, but it's got 1,000 horsepower. And everybody goes, ooh.
And if you break it down by 1 horsepower per every dollar spending, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that compares to a few other vehicles. But people aren't buying that car to actually drive it that much. They're having it as a status symbol. And while I'm sure that there will be some race car drivers and people taking it to the track, I mean, that's really a status symbol car, $3 million, and very low, low, low production, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, my thing is that, okay, so does your generation still venerate horsepower?
I do. I would argue that horsepower still matters to certain buyers and a lot of buyers. And if someone who doesn't even know or cover the industry or know much about cars gets into a vehicle with, say, a 4-cylinder and then hops into a V6 or a turbocharged engine, they might not know why they like it. But as soon as they hit that pedal, they can tell that they like this model better than that model. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're talking about overall industry, performance will still sell, whether it's muscle cars or down to minivans. Getting off the line and being able to actually maneuver in traffic and get on the highway matters to people.
Yep. No, I'd agree with that.
Okay.
And with that, we ought to wrap this up.
By the way, that Ranger was a 4-cylinder just...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Just thought I'd point that out.
I was driving the Chevy 4-cylinder Silverado a little bit ago, so, I mean, it's an interesting industry when you've got 1,000 horsepower and then 4-cylinder engine and pickup trucks.
There you go.
Yeah, maybe next week we can talk more about the driving impressions of the Ranger, but I think Ford will do decent with this thing. I do. So, but anyway, Mike Whalen, thanks so much for coming on the show again. It's
always
really
fun.
Good to have you here.
Always fun, guys.
And Gary, good seeing you. And, of course... Good seeing all of you out there.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.